Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Stephen Pimpar, author of the book A People's History of Poverty in America, who assesses a recent U.S. Census report which found that poor and middle-class incomes remain flat as poverty levels stagnate. Jacqueline Patterson of the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program, who discusses the goals of the recent International Women's Earth and Climate Initiative Summit. And Ladd Everett of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, who talks about his group's reaction to the most recent mass shooting at the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C., and continuing nationwide efforts to mandate stricter gun safety laws. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On the eve of the United Nations General Assembly in New York, Iran released 11 prominent political prisoners, including human rights lawyer Nasrin Sotoudeh, in a sign of a possible thaw in Iranian domestic politics. At the same time, Iran's new president, Hassan Rouhani, exchanged letters with U.S. President Obama amid increasing talk of a hoped-for negotiated settlement over the West's objections to Tehran's nuclear program. Rouhani, seen as a centrist in Iran, did an in-depth interview with NBC correspondent Ann Curry, where the Iranian president endorsed new freedoms for Iranian citizens, including open dialogue. Trita Parsi of the National Iranian American Council told the Guardian newspaper, if the West fails to appreciate Rouhani's flexibility now, it will have to deal with the inflexibility of the conservatives in a few months. According to the Christian Science Monitor, inside Iran, the prisoner release is viewed as a break with the hardline agenda of former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad that turned to repression after the disputed 2009 election. One Tehran political analyst observed that hardliners these days are silent because Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has now embraced President Rouhani and the strategy of historic flexibility. After his recent election victory, incoming Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott has pushed through a new hard-right agenda, including repealing his nation's carbon tax and imposing harsh new laws excluding foreign asylum seekers. His refugee policy is opposed by human rights groups and could provoke a diplomatic fight with the government of Indonesia. During his swearing-in, Abbott, a social conservative, pledged that the flood of boats with asylum seekers will be returned to Indonesian waters. Abbott is now proposing to buy up Indonesian fishing boats to prevent them from falling into the hands of smugglers. Most of the asylum seekers are from Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, and Sri Lanka, and travel through dangerous Indonesian waters to reach Australia. Graham McGregor of Amnesty International blasted the new Abbott policy as not only complete disregard for the asylum seekers, but absolute contempt for legal and moral obligations. Further, human rights groups have charged that the conditions at Australia's asylum processing center on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea are appalling. The Obama administration is launching a big push to sign up 7 million uninsured Americans through the Affordable Care Act's new health care exchanges, which launch on October 1st. A major challenge will be signing up young adults, the millennial generation who supported President Obama in large numbers during both the 2008 and 2012 elections. According to the Christian Science Monitor, states which have set up health exchanges plan to spend millions of dollars in marketing the new options for health insurance coverage. Yet most of the states with the highest rates of uninsured are not promoting exchanges and instead are leaving it up to the federal government. Meanwhile, Republicans in Congress are withholding approval of the federal budget that could close down government and threatening to default on the nation's debt later this year unless the White House accedes to their demands to defund Obamacare. The Commonwealth Fund, in a recent report, found that only 27% of 19 to 29-year-olds were aware of the new health care exchanges, and many millennials decline enrolling in health insurance at work because premiums remain so expensive, while many continue to struggle with heavy college loan debts. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
The sluggish economic recovery from the depths of the Great Recession that began in 2008 hasn't yet reached the nation's poor middle class, according to a recent U.S. Census Bureau report for 2012. The data reveals that as 2 million more jobs were created last year and the nation's corporations raked in big profits, the average income of American households remained frozen. Further, the report found that 46.5 million people are living below the poverty line in America, or 15% of the total population, the same rate as in 2011, but a larger overall number. Poverty income is calculated at $23,492 in annual income for a family of four. Those living in poverty included an estimated 16.1 million children and 3.9 million senior citizens aged 65 years or older. Many of the jobs created since 2008 have been in the service sector, with hourly pay at or near the minimum wage. The stagnating economy has provoked new labor union organizing drives among poorly paid retail and fast food workers. About the only good news in the census report was a slight decline in the number of people without health insurance, attributed in part to the new Affordable Care Act. Your reporter spoke with Columbia University adjunct professor of social work, Stephen Pimper, author of the book A People's History of Poverty in America. Here he assesses the significance of the Census Bureau data and public policy options to alleviate poverty and reverse the nation's growing income inequality.
15% of the population overall was poor. That was 26% for Hispanics, 27% for African Americans, 22% for children under the age of 18, and 9% for people over the age of 65. So we see a lot of variation, official rates that are almost twice as high for Hispanics and African Americans, and just under that for children, and not quite half the rate for those over the age of 65. So we see lots of that kind of variation, higher in the South than it is in the North, which has historically always been true, but somehow winds up surprising people, I think. I think too often people tend to think of poverty as this northern and urban phenomenon, and in fact, it's consistently higher in the South and consistently higher in non-metropolitan areas than it is in metropolitan areas.
How much of what we're seeing here in terms of the really negative numbers in terms of income and poverty owes to the Great Recession that started in 2007, 2008? And how much of this is really owing to longer term trends?
Yeah, well, it's I mean, that 15% rate, that's about 2.5 percentage points higher than it was prior to the onset of the Great Recession. So make no mistake, there have certainly been fairly profound effects of that recession, which for in technical economic terms has ended, but of course in terms of the actual well-being of large numbers of the American public continues on. But I mean, I think that there's a larger story here about the continued high rates of poverty. As I said, it's about where it was in the early 90s, about where it was in the early late 80s. We haven't seen a long period of consistent decline in the poverty rate since the period in the immediate years after World War II. That in fact, since 1973, pick almost any indicator that you would like of economic well-being, and what you find is Americans either in stagnation or things getting worse.
The Republican Party has targeted the poor for cuts in food stamps, unemployment insurance. There's wide discussion of cutting back major pieces of the social safety net like Medicare and Social Security. And even President Obama has, entered the race mm-hmm. to the bottom with offers of the chain CPI, which would yep. effectively cut back people's social the security benefits. Yep. What can we learn from other countries in how they have bolstered the poor and given them a leg up so they can participate more fully in the economy? Maybe you could speak yep. to the kinds of public policies we need to implement here in this country as opposed to the scapegoating policies.
Yeah. I'll say in some ways, I think of that as actually the easy part, the policy part. I mean, if we look at the rest of the world, Pretty much every other rich democracy on the planet has a lower rate of poverty than we do, a lower rate of child poverty, lower rates of inequality, et cetera. They all go about doing that in different kinds of ways. They structure their programs in different ways. They finance them in different ways. And some do this more effectively than others. But there is absolutely no shortage of programs around the world that we could look at to think about how to, that demonstrated ways of reducing poverty. Moreover, we could look at what we've done here in the United States, right? I mean, it's prior to 1959, right, the year when we've got sort of the first official set of Census Bureau data, highest poverty rate among every demographic group in the United States were people over the age of 65. Today, lowest poverty rate among any demographic group is people over the age of 65. Why? Social Security and, to a lesser extent, Medicare. How did we reduce poverty among poor people? We gave them money, right? We send old people a check every month, and that makes them less poor. Right now, obviously, it's a bit more complicated than that, but I don't think it's terribly more complicated than that, right? I mean, there's that kind of direct relation. We do this in poor families with the earned income tax credit, right? It's sort of the more hours you work, if you have low wages, you not only get taxes back from the IRS, but maybe something over and above that. Probably the greatest anti-poverty effects of any program we've got other than Social Security itself. Right? We even have programs already in operation here that have enormously powerful anti-poverty reduction effects. Right? I mean, as bad as things are, without the American social welfare safety net, poverty rates would be at least twice what they are now. So they're failing because we've still got 15% of the population, 46 million people in poverty, but that would be closer to 80 million, maybe 100 million in the absence of that, right? The challenge is the politics, right? The challenge is the politics because it doesn't matter how rational and effective a policy is. We've got a political system right now that is dysfunctional, to say the least, and I think is tipping over into the edge of something that goes beyond merely dysfunctional. And I think that's a larger kind of problem that we need to confront before we worry about whether we're designing good policy.
That was Columbia University Adjunct Professor of Social Work Stephen Pimpare, author of the book A People's History of Poverty in America. For more analysis and commentary on the effects of the stagnating U.S. economy, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. At a three-day conference, September 20th through the 23rd in Suffern, New York, 100 women environmental leaders from around the world convened to share their experiences and hammer out a women's climate action agenda. The International Women's Earth and Climate Initiative Summit included equal representation from both industrial and developing nations around the globe, including many indigenous leaders from North America, the Amazon, and Africa. One of the key issues raised at the conference was that of carbon trading, in which polluting corporations provide benefits, such as planting trees in one part of the world, in order to offset their continuing pollution in another location. While supported by many governments, corporations, and big environmental groups, every summit delegate who spoke on the issue opposed it. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus attended the summit and spoke with Jacqueline Patterson, director of the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program and co-founder and coordinator of Women of Color United. Here she addresses the issue of carbon trading and explains why she believes that the climate justice movement is not a subset of other mainstream groups working on climate issues in the U.S., where these organizations are still overwhelmingly white, attracting little participation from people of color.
I think a lot of people wouldn't necessarily characterize the climate justice movement as being a subset of the larger climate movement. And in fact, many people would say the climate justice movement is a broader view of looking at climate change. So it's looking at climate change within a context of broader social justice issues, so social, political, economic issues, and how climate change fits into, and our movement to address climate change fits into that broader conversation. So I think in order to really see more merging of the various disparate efforts on climate change, I believe that folks who are in the climate movement that are more focused on climate alone would need to have some conversations about how to broaden that analysis and broaden how we actually work on these issues in a more holistic way. So for us, we're actually very explicitly having a number of conversations to try to figure out how we can bring that together a little bit more and have more collaboration among movements. For example, the NAACP is soon coming out with a white paper called And the People Shall Lead that actually comes from several conversations with frontline community groups as well as big enviro groups about how we can work better together. What are the current barriers now? What are some promising models and practices that where people have worked together well? And how can we upscale those models of success? And how can we address the challenges in collaborations? There's a couple of initiatives that have, I guess, been born from those efforts, such as the Climate Justice Alliance, which was originally called the Climate Justice Alignment Process. And it was really looking at this question of how to have more alignment within the climate justice movement. And then we also have this building kind of equity and alignment that was facilitated by the Overbrook Foundation, actually. And they've pulled together a number of big greens and climate justice frontline communities and philanthropists to really talk about this conversation about how we can better collaborate.
Can you give us a little peek at this white paper and any example of, you know, what's in the paper of a successful collaboration?
Sure. So some of the challenges have included recognizing the constraints of even some of the big greens often, and that they're often driven by funding that calls for certain deliverables in a certain time frame. But for us, if we're looking at this broader issue around social, economic, political rights and a larger climate justice framing and social justice framing, while we recognize that we need to have incremental goals like shutting down that power plant or starting that community-owned solar project or whatever, we also need to always be doing that within a broader strategic frame. And so we come into conflict when there are these short-term goals that might even be counter to that longer-term frame. For example, carbon markets. For us, in some ways, trading in a carbon market often means that some communities end up continuing to suffer because a company has been allowed to kind of trade for the right to continue polluting in one area. And so for us, you know, that's a fundamental challenge, and we can't support any kind of effort that's going to be moving in that direction. So that's just one example. In terms of some successes, one of the things that I'm actually writing up now in terms of a scenario in that paper is I just spoke with someone who's an environmental justice organizer with the Sierra Club. Fortunately, Sierra Club has started a discrete environmental justice program, and they have an organizer out in Minnesota who worked actually with the NAACP branch, and what they did was the Sierra Club members who are part of that Sierra Club chapter all joined the NAACP branch. Instead of kind of coming in and kind of saying at them, like, you need to be doing this, you need to be that, doing that, join us, they actually joined the NAACP branch. They worked together with NAACP on whatever issues they were working on and also began to introduce the issues that they were working on in terms of environment. And together they ended up working together on some things.
For this Women's Summit right now, what do you hope will come out of this gathering of 100 women from all over the world, all of whom are doing amazing work in their own countries?
Yes. I'm very excited about this gathering because there's so much in that we're doing. In the U.S., we talk about this whole NIMBY thing in terms of not in my backyard. So we want to make sure that we're creating policies so that certain practices can't happen in other neighborhoods, can't move from one neighborhood to another. And now we have this new construction called NOPE, which is not on planet Earth. And so we feel when we have these international gatherings together, then we can really talk about how we can set standards and practices and so forth that would transcend borders. So right now we have the situation with coal-fired power plants. While we're shutting down coal plants here, it's all well and good, but it's actually pushing the coal export industry. So we do have to talk to our sisters around the world about how we can make sure that there's no quarter for practices like burning dirty coal or whatever the practice is, so that we have a concerted effort to address those issues instead of just kind of doing it piecemeal in each of our respective countries.
That was Jacqueline Patterson of the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program. Learn more about the Women's Climate Action Agenda by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The latest in a long series of mass casualty shootings across America occurred on September 16th when accused gunman Aaron Alexis, a technology contractor for the U.S. government with security clearance, killed 12 people in a bloody rampage at Washington, D.C.'s Navy Yard before being shot and killed himself. Alexis, who had a history of violence and exhibited signs of mental illness, reportedly test-fired an AR-15 military-style assault rifle at a Virginia gun store the week before the massacre, but was prevented from buying one because he didn't live in state. Alexis instead purchased an 870 Remington pump-action shotgun that was used to commit the mass murder. According to columnist David Sirota, gun violence now claims 87 American lives each day and has killed or wounded almost 1 million Americans between 2001 and 2010. In historical terms, he states, more people have died from gun violence in America since 1968 than have died in all U.S. wars combined. Your reporter spoke with Ladd Everett, director of communications with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. He talks about his group's reaction to the mass shooting at the Navy Yard in Washington and continuing nationwide efforts since last year's Newtown, Connecticut school massacre to mandate universal background checks for all gun buyers and pass laws banning military-style assault rifles and high-capacity ammunition magazines.
I think the one recurring element of many of these tragedies that's so disturbing is that so many of the mass shooters that we're seeing have legally purchased their guns. And, you know, these are individuals that have, you know, numerous red flags in their backgrounds indicating that they were a threat to themselves and or others. You know, I don't think Aaron Alexis is any different. I think he's, you know, a textbook example of that. You know, there is so much in his background that should have set off numerous red flags and should have caused any civilized country to deny him, you know, gun purchases or gun ownership. You know, he had two previous arrests for gun-related offenses. In one of them, he fired a round through his apartment ceiling and nearly killed a woman upstairs from him. He said it was an accident. She swore to police it was intentional and that he had confronted her before about making noise. He also shot out a construction worker's tires on his car because he said the man disrespected him, and Alexis described that as an, quote-unquote, anger-fueled blackout. The mental illness that he was dealing with has been, I think, well documented. You know, one of the scarier episodes occurred in Rhode Island, where he ended up staying in three different hotels one night because he thought that he was hearing voices through the ceiling and floor. He thought people were sending microwaves at him. Police were actually called when he reached the third hotel and interviewed him and recorded that. But again, it wasn't something, given our current disqualifications for gun buyers, that would have stopped him from buying the shotgun he bought. And then finally, you know, the discharge from the military, from the Navy, that was an honorable discharge, but where there was a substantial record of misconduct and even drunkenness. I don't know how you could write a script with more warning signs that someone is potentially violent, but, you know, sadly, that's what constitutes a quote-unquote law-abiding gun owner in the United States at this point.
Ladd Everett, because the NRA is so powerful, in the wake of this mass shooting at the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C., NRA spokesperson Wayne LaPierre was on all the talk shows, and people were getting his comments on this horrendous incident. And he talked about the need for more guns, criticizing the lack of security, guards with more guns at the Navy Yard and anywhere else there's a mass shooting incident. The NRA solution seems to be more guns. I wonder how you react to this kind of response, very predictable response from the NRA.
You know, I get the sense that LaPierre is almost running out of things to say. You know, he was on Meet the Press this weekend with David Gregory. First, LaPierre claimed to Gregory that there were no good guys with guns on the scene. Then when Gregory corrected him and said, listen, you know, he shot three people who were good guys with guns on that scene. And it took basically an army of, you know, federal, local, and God knows what other law enforcement agents, 30 minutes to bring this guy down. Then LaPierre's argument was, well, we need even more good guys with guns on the scene. And David Gregory brought up the point that it seemed to be a sliding scale with LaPierre. First, after Newtown, he tells us we need one security guard in every school. Okay, now after a shooting on a military base where there was law enforcement everywhere, he's telling us, oh, well, that's not good enough on any military facility. Every military member should be carrying a gun at that facility. Well, you know, one of the fallacies of that that's so obvious is that prior to the minute he started killing people, Aaron Alexis was a good guy with a gun. Aaron Alexis had a concealed handgun permit from the state of Texas. So, you know, the whole thing is just utterly insane. LaPierre is well aware, number one, that more guns certainly don't make us safer because all the data shows otherwise. It shows that if you own a firearm, you're more at risk for firearm homicide and suicide. But then also he's well aware that with our current screening process, there's no way we can tell who's a good guy and a bad guy simply based on the fact that you may or may not have passed a gun background check.
Members of Congress have continually blocked any meaningful legislation to implement universal background checks or restrict the sale of military-style firearms or these high-capacity ammunition magazines. What is the public feeling about this legislation that's been blocked in both houses of Congress, and what can be done about it?
The public support for expanding background checks is still off the charts. It's still enormously high. It's still strong majority support, even in, you know, the reddest districts in America. You know, I saw an interesting poll today, too, taken a couple of years ago of federally licensed gun dealers who, again showed majority support for expanding some of the current disqualifications to, example, to apply to people who are alcohol abusers or who have violent aggravated assaults, but might be, let's say, misdemeanor convictions instead of felony convictions. I think across a wide political spectrum, there's a lot of support for doing a lot of things that we currently don't have on the books in our laws. You know, I think the key to all of this, obviously, is defeating the NRA in Congress in terms of weakening their power and exposing them. And then, you know, I think another part of this, and, you know, no matter what issue you feel right now you're dealing with it, is that, you know, we have a very dysfunctional Congress right now. Controversial issues are one thing, but, you know, this is a Congress that can't even handle things that are routine and non-controversial. Things that used to be taken care of, you know, via unanimous consent are now, teeth-grinding, painful things to get done. So that's a problem, and, you know, that's a we the people thing we're going to have to solve through elections.
That was Ladd Everett, Director of Communications with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Learn more about the groups advocating stricter gun regulation by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.